Welcome to the Ecclesia Hollywood podcast and the teaching series Unstoppable, the community of God in the book of Acts.
Good morning. Good to see all of you. Not the overwhelming. Good morning. And next week, daylight savings time, you're really going to be dragging. Things to pray for, lots of things happening here. Let me just kind of skip through the next 7 days because you may want to jot these down or at least remember them to pray for. Just such a fun thing for me to see half of our outreach lead team standing up here with Lindsay and Micah and Jen. There's another half to that team. I get the privilege of meeting with them, and we have fun. We have fun looking at local and global opportunities, and not just what that team can do, that's really not the question, but it's what can we as a church do. This afternoon, after this service and after we get some food at the lunch truck, all of the lead teams are going to be gathering in the cafe, and we're just continuing to journey together, work together, put our heads together. It's fun, so pray for that. This next week, our lead pastor search interview team continues to meet and move forward in that process. Pray for them. We have our steering team meeting as they look at the challenging question, how do we live within our financial means while still exercising faith? And a week from today, the elders meet for the afternoon because we have four new elders that have come on board. And so we're going to do some understanding each other things and some orienting. There's a lot of good things going on, and those are just meetings, let alone all the good work and ministry that happens on a daily basis through all of us that are here. Let me ask you to engage in a simple exercise. You don't have to move. You don't even have to talk to the people around you. All you have to do is react inside your own head and gut. In a moment, I'm going to say a word. It's not even a long word. It's only two letters, so it shouldn't be too tough. When you hear that word, what reactions does it trigger inside you? And all I want you to do is sit with that for a minute and just see how that word affects you. So get ready. Here comes the word, big two-letter word. You ready? Go. What feelings stir up when you hear the word go? What reactions are going on inside you? Go. Let's see how you compare to the first service. How many of you had that word triggered positive feelings? Okay, thank you. How many of you it triggered actually negative feelings? Yeah, you're about like the first service. How many of you it didn't trigger positive or negative feelings, it triggered questions? We had that in the first service. How many of you found that to be a light, enjoyable word? A few of you. How many of you found that to be a heavy word? A lot more of you. Okay. We're going to simmer in the word go today. But don't jump to conclusions and assume, oh, I know he's going to tell me to go somewhere. That's above my pay grade. It's not my job to tell you where to go. Although I've had people tell me where to go, and I could have gone many places based on all the suggestions they made to me. Which reminds me of a very funny story in a church, but I'll have to tell it to you afterwards if you want to hear it. But it really is funny, but ask me afterwards. So let me tell you about my February and some of the places I've gone. I suddenly feel like a Dr. Seuss book. Oh, the places you'll go. So here is the first photo I want you to look at. Here is the next generation of our family. So Owen shows up yesterday, 3:28 a.m., I know because I was there. In fact, I was there all night the night before. They took our daughter-in-law in Friday at lunchtime to break the water and begin labor and delivery. And my wife said, I think we need to be there at lunchtime. And I said, I don't think so. She says, no, she's going to have this baby quickly. And I said, no, I mean, far be it for me to talk to a woman about labor, but I said, I think this may take longer than you think. And so Liz said, well, I'm going now. So off she went. She was at the hospital at 2. And I said, well, I'll come at dinner time. So Liz got there at 2 in the afternoon. I got there at 6, but we both were going, and we got there. She was there at 2. I was there at 6. And Liz was there 13 and a half hours before the baby was born. I was there a mere 9 and a half hours. We have other photos of us, you know, contorted on chairs in the waiting room, you know. And, of course, our daughter-in-law's parents and relatives were there. So it was a marathon, but we get Owen out of it. And my son tells me 95% certainty Owen's middle name will be Reginald. So if that holds, so don't go, like, viral with that yet, because... but if it holds, it's going to be Owen Reginald Murphy. Now, you might think, oh, you know, that's nice. My oldest daughter's reaction was, bam! And the reason it's bam is because Reginald is my father's name. My 86-year-old fading father is named Reginald Thomas Murphy. And this photo is made possible because my father immigrated. At the age of 2, he and his parents left what was familiar to them and came here in great poverty. And so his story is sort of the American success story of a sort. But that allowed this to be normal for me. So when Greg said, what's your favorite part of LA? You know, where are you from? So some of you know this, but I grew up in Altadena. So I'm a local, I'm a native. But that's because my father and his family were willing to go from what was familiar to what was highly unfamiliar. And this became normal for me. And so Owen, 95% possibly Reginald Murphy, when I see my 86-year-old Irish immigrant father next weekend, I get the privilege of showing him this photo and saying, you have a second grandchild, and his middle name is named after you. We will never forget you for going. It changed the course of our family story. And then there's always fun subplots. So one of the subplots is Owen being born yesterday, February 28th at 3:28 a.m., we have one other grandchild, our 7-year-old granddaughter, who was born 7 years ago on February 28th. She's not happy. She said yesterday, no fair, it's my day. So apparently we have a little bit of a sharing problem in our family tree we're going to have to work on. She's hoarding February 28th is her day, not willing to share it with Owen just yet. We'll get there. We've got time. But she's not willing to give it away. That was the last day of February for me. I had the great joy and privilege and adventure of some other pictures. I'll briefly take you through them. Triggered because several years ago, I said to my wife, someday I'm going to die, and it's going to be all Americans at my funeral, and that's going to be really sad. And she said, what's sad about that? And I said, America has most of the resources. So all the haves are going to be sitting at my funeral talking about, you know, Paul's a nice guy and Paul helped us. And she said, well, what's your point? And I said, my point is there's most of the rest of the world has far less resource and access than we do. And I'm spending all my time helping the people who have access to all kinds of resources. And so the result of all that is I get to go to Haiti and Uganda. So I go to Uganda twice a year, so I spent half the month of February back again in Uganda. So these are just a few of the pictures from that trip. I go. It's a great privilege to go. So here's some of the kids. If you just scroll through the pictures, you'll see we got there and we spent the first day training 11 Ugandans. The man on the far right, Bishop Patrick Okabe, has started upwards of 150 churches in eastern Uganda. He's a church planting whiz. But often, the people who then pastor those churches are bivocational, untrained people that he now puts in charge of that local church. And then he calls Mark and me and he says, we need training for these pastors. That's what you guys do, right? And so we come, and along the way, the way it's developed is we've said to him, if you keep having Americans coming to train, there's not a whole lot of future in that. But if the Americans can train Ugandan leaders and the Ugandans can train Ugandans, we're on to something now. So the first day there, these are the 11 men that we spent the entire day with, and we trained them, using the term a bit loosely because it was kind of like an informational dump, of 11 pages of Mark's and my material on Christian parenting. Day two, so imagine you get 8 hours of stuff laid on you, and the next day you've got to step up and present it in a new town with a new group. So that's where we went from there. We took the top four guys, and if you go to the next slide, you'll see this was the view every day for the next 7 days in the van. On the left is Noah, the middle is Kenneth, the right is Simon. The head that you're staring at the back of in the seat that we would call the driver's seat, it's actually the passenger, is David. Those are the four Ugandans that we were together with for the next 7 days. They doing the bulk of the training that Mark and I trained them in. And if you scroll through some of these pictures, you can see them at work. So the next photo, what you'll see is Simon teaching in Iganga. One day after Mark and I oriented him, Simon is teaching. Now, Simon is a wonderful guy. He was beaten and robbed by five guys and left in a coma for dead about 4 years ago. Relatives and other friends came to his wife and said, you better prepare for a funeral and start looking for a new husband because you don't want to be alone in Uganda as a widow at your age. And as he told this whole story, he said, instead, my wife got up and his phrase was, put on her smudge, which is our word for makeup. She smudged every morning, made herself look very beautiful for him, even though he was in a coma. And she told everybody who told her, it's over, give up on Simon and find a new husband. And he said she looked at every person and said, my husband will not die. He's going to live and serve the Lord. And it was a long road back. But I can tell you, Simon is back, and he is dynamic, and he's wonderful. He was sharing that story during the part of the training session, which had to do with, as Christian parents, never give up on your kids. And he shared that story. And when he leaned over and looked at the crowd and said to them, never give up, it had some grip to it, given what he's lived through. So that's Simon, wonderful guy, brother that we have the privilege of working with. You go to the next picture, Noah, one of our other presenters and trainers, very different than Simon, theologically, a lot of depth, more of a teacher, does very well. Kenneth is translating for him. Go to the next picture. This is the typical scene we would have there, plastic chairs always, colorful plastic chairs, but always plastic chairs. So this is a crowd in one of the towns we went to. You can see Simon in the foreground in the left. Keep going through more pictures. We'll just kind of quickly take you to some places. Fairly new for Ugandan couples to sit together, interact together in a public setting. And so here this couple's working through our notes. You can kind of see the combination of, I'm enjoying this, but oh, this is new for me. Many of them had that reaction. If you go to the next picture, these are two of our three guys. So Julius is on the left. He's in one of the towns. You can see Simon in the middle. There's David on the right. David's father has 10 wives. He has 31 siblings. Through those 10 women. David's story is his father beat him so regularly and excessively that David ran away from home and became a street boy and survived by cutting up mattresses and selling the foam so he could get enough food to eat as he roamed the streets. Today, as a 32-year-old man, David's the associate pastor of the main church in eastern Uganda and is becoming the senior pastor of that church. The Lord's changing lives. It's very exciting. Go to the next picture. And you thought Moses was a big, tall guy with a beard and was white. But he's not. Moses is 5'6", and he's Ugandan. This is Moses, my good friend, at the hotel. I would come down and swim laps in the morning, starting with my friend there a year ago, and Moses started teaching me phrases in the local dialect, and he's rather a drill sergeant about it. He doesn't just offer you a phrase, you have to say it right, and he keeps making you say it right. So Moses has become my language tutor. And as I was getting ready to come back this time in February, one of the things I was praying for was that I'd have a chance to share the gospel of Christ with Moses. You might think, well, how hard is that? Just share it with him. But when you come in as an American into this setting, there are a lot of things built in and you have to navigate around them. One of the things built in is because you're a white Westerner, automatically you're given too much respect and deferential treatment. So I could easily force Moses to listen to the gospel presentation, and he would, out of respect because I'm a white Westerner. I didn't want it to feel staged. I didn't want him to feel cornered or uncomfortable. So I was just praying about that. But I thought, I'm going all the way to Uganda. Moses and I have a relationship. I want to share Christ with him, but not in a way that feels controlling. And so as we were visiting at the pool, Moses said to me early in the week, he said, I won't be here tomorrow because my neighbor died of HIV/AIDS, and so I go to the funeral tomorrow. And I said, Moses, I'm so sorry to hear that. And he says, well, he says, everyone dies. That's the end. And I said, you know, actually, there's someone who died and it wasn't the end. And he looked at me and I told him about Jesus rising from the dead. And I said, not only did he do that, Moses, but I said, that's how we can have a relationship with God as a gift rather than wondering if we've lived a good enough life. Because Jesus died for us and he's alive. He so wants relationship with us. It's a gift. And the Lord opened this wonderful door to share the gospel with Moses in a way that wasn't controlling or manipulative or anything else. And so there's my buddy Moses. As we went to the different regions and presented the training, and the Ugandan trainers were doing so well, the most frequent comment we got back from Ugandans time and time again was a five-word phrase. They would look at us and say, thank you for loving us. Which, you know, it's very sweet and touching. And I said, well, you know, you're easy to love. And they said, no, you've come so far. And we know this is expensive. And you've come here, and you've come to us. And you've come out of comfort to this. Thank you for loving us. And of course, as Micah and the outreach folks, Lindsay and Jen said, when you do it, you get so much back. It enriches your life. But the reason I asked you to think about the word go is I think go is God's middle name. In fact, if I wanted to play with it too much, and I won't, but I'll just tell you I could have, you know, the word go is in God's name. So here's a strange thing. Mark 1, verse 35 to 39. You don't need to turn there because it'll go up on the screen. Actually, while it's going on the screen, if you turn to Acts chapter 13, and if you're using that paper Bible right in front of you, it's page 768. So Mark 1, 35 to 39, let's just stop there on our way to Acts 13, because Jesus does something that is counterintuitive. He does something that few of us would do, and especially in the Western American church world, we would not do this. So watch what he does that's so oddly different, and more importantly, why does he do it? Because what they do is they hit a vein of, and I'll use a crude, crass word I don't really like, but they hit success. They hit a gusher. They are ministering, and they hit a huge need, and people are flocking to Jesus. He'd been healing the previous day, and as sunset hit, more people brought more people who needed a divine touch of healing and releasing, and more and more and more people came, and then word spread, and more people came, and so the next morning, it's standing room only, it's sold out, and then some, and there's just one problem. Mark 1, verse 35 says, very early in the morning, while it was still dark, Jesus got up, left the house, and went off to a solitary place where he prayed. Simon and his companions went to look for him, because here's the situation. The disciples, new to this spiritual movement led by this grassroots leader, Jesus, the son of a carpenter, new to all of this, and suddenly we've got crowds and crowds and more crowds. This is magic in the spiritual sense. This is really, wow, it's amazing. And we can't find Jesus. Everything's great except where's the guy who does the wonders? He's gone. He's missing. How did he oversleep? What's happening? So they're looking for him. Finally, they find him out in this solitary place. And at this point, if you're using the Bible from the rack in front of you, the translation really fades badly for us. Verse 37 says, when they found him, they exclaimed, everyone is looking for you. And that's not what they said. The reason is because the Greek tells us what their attitude is. Their attitude is a combination of stunned and pissed off. So they don't come to him and say, everyone's looking for you. Like it's good news. They're like, everyone's looking for you. In other words, what the, you know what, are you doing out here? Because everybody's there, and you're not. We've hit on something. We could franchise this, if I use modern language. We figured out a recipe for success, and where are you? You're off having a little prayer retreat. It's not the time to have a prayer retreat. We've got success waiting at the doorstep, and you're absentee. That's the attitude behind the English translation, everyone's looking for you. It is. If you think, where'd you get that, Paul? Come see me, I'll give you the Greek. Jesus replied, this is telling. But do you see how counterintuitive it is to them? We've got success here. I mean, what would we do if all of a sudden our attendance tripled or quadrupled? We'd have more services. Of course we would. More people. Got to make more services. Doesn't mean that's necessarily wrong, but that's so immediately American and Western. Wow, success. Would we feel better because we're a church of 1,200 instead of a church of 300, 350, whatever we are? Huh. There are churches that have thousands of people that may not be as healthy as churches that have 100 and 200. Because it all depends what health really means, and it all depends why a church exists. But it's not a big holding tank like an aquarium to get more fish in. And that's what the disciples thought. Gosh, we got more fish. Need a bigger aquarium. Everyone's looking for you. Verse 38, Jesus replied, I mean, how counterintuitive is this? This is brilliantly awful. Let's go. Oh, there it is. Let's go somewhere else. Let's walk away from what appears to be success. Let's walk away. Not just because Jesus is afraid to be successful, humanly speaking. Let's go somewhere else to the nearby villages so I can preach there also. And then it's this one's the rainmaker at the end. That's why I've come. I didn't come to gather crowds. I didn't come to have a big speaking auditorium full of people. I came to reach more and more people. Not just to gather them in an aquarium. That's why I've come. So he traveled throughout Galilee, preaching in their synagogues and driving out demons. But apparently numbers and numerical growth made no difference to Jesus. It just didn't score on the meter for him. Because I got to be going. Got to go. When the disciples wanted to set up shop and say, people can come. Interestingly, there's no verse in the Bible that tells people come to church. But there are a number of verses in the Bible that tells the church, go into the world. So it's a little two-letter word, says a whole lot to us. And of course, then we have the end of Matthew's gospel where Jesus says, all authority has been given to me in heaven and on earth. And having declared that, what good is that? Well, the next sentence he says to them, so go, because I have authority. Go and make disciples everywhere. Andy Stanley, I like how he said it. He was describing the church as it's forming in Acts. And he says this, the movement stopped moving. The gathering stopped growing. They were not moving. Instead, they started huddling. So the Lord said, it's time to stir things up. And then Andy Stanley imagines how the Lord's thought process went. So I'll let Andy Stanley share with you his imagining. The Lord said, it's time to stir things up. We got to get these people moving again instead of camping and staying put. We need somebody who's a catalytic mover. I know. What if we pick someone who's actually an enemy of the Christian movement, somebody who's really knowledgeable that actually has been persecuting them? What if we could get somebody like that to do a 180 and suddenly have all that zeal now in favor of Christ and Christianity. But they've got to be willing to go. They've got to be willing to be uncomfortable. They've got to be willing to take risks and even get beaten and suffer. But if we could find somebody like that to entice them to say yes to that job description, I'll let them write half the New Testament. That's Andy Stanley's imagining of how Jesus and the Apostle Paul ended up coming to a deal. Not sure it was a deal, but he's kind of there. And that brings us to our passage in Acts 13. So the church in Jerusalem has stopped moving. It has circled the wagons, and it has become inward and supportive of each other in a loving, caring, generous place with lots of squeaky wheels. We'll hear about that next week. But they are no longer going. Lots of reasons why, but they're not really going. They're not on mission. They're sitting. And so here's this other church in Acts 13. And now we start hearing about this one because it's different. This is the church you want to go to. In many ways, this is the church probably most like Ecclesia. It's the church at Antioch. The reason I say that is just look at the roster of names. Starting in chapter 13 of Acts in verse 1, the church at Antioch, there were prophets and teachers, and then we're told some of their names. And these are not kosher Jewish names. This isn't traditional, old school deal. Barnabas, well, he's from the island of Cyprus in the Mediterranean. Simeon, called Niger, Lucius of Cyrene, Manaen, who had been brought up with Herod the Tetrarch. Wait a minute. He's childhood buddies with the guy who rules the area? Herod, like the king Herod? Yeah, he's my like childhood friend. These people have interesting connections. They're not just steeped in a long line of Jewish lineage. The Antioch church is an eclectic church. There are Greeks in the church. There are highly educated people, and there are people with powerful connections and relationships in this church. And then last, any reason why he's named last? Don't know. Saul is there. This guy who had a zeal for hunting down, persecuting, imprisoning, and killing people who said they believed Jesus was the Messiah because he thought it was heresy. And he's there. This is not a dull place. So here they are, the prophetic leaders of the church. In verse 2 says, while they were worshiping the Lord and fasting, the Holy Spirit said, now what do you think the Holy Spirit's going to say? And that's not a theological question, okay? Just it's really like a review. Have you been listening so far? The Holy Spirit's going to say, go, watch. They fast and pray. Set apart for me Barnabas and Saul for the work to which I've called them. So after they had fasted and prayed, they placed their hands on them and they said, go. They sent them out. Go. I'm so happy to be back, having been gone all of February between Uganda and having grandchildren and telling my granddaughter, you have to share your birthday. And this is the 14th intentional interim that I've had the privilege of doing. Before that, I had two permanent, I mean, why do we call them permanent? Two long-term lead pastor jobs in churches where, you know, I'm there until I'm not there anymore. The second of those two, the first 3 years were just pinch me great. Literally, as I was moving to begin serving that church, the chairman of the board, who I'd already had lots of conversations with by phone, and we were building a nice friendship, and he said to me, we have five couples all in their 20s from our church who feel a call of God to go out and serve God in other parts of the world. And he said, we want you to train them and then send them and then keep tabs on them. And I had the most fun. It was like the most fun job ever. I got there and I got to know all these five couples. They had gotten a sense of it's time for us to go because of the previous pastor there, David Fisher, who was very much a catalytic, motivational, prophetic kind of guy. So all five knew were going. They even knew where they were going. One couple was going to Vienna, Austria, to work within the Lutheran seminary to actually bring relationship with Christ to people that in this staid, sterile environment. There are many pastors today in Austria who have vibrant relationships with Christ and are leading their churches in that direction because of the ministry Vic and Kathy quietly had for years. Wonderful couple. We sent our best to Austria. Then there were three couples, all very close friends, who together felt called to go within the denomination and plant a church plant within Rio de Janeiro. And so we sent three of our very best to Rio. Then there was a fifth couple. They were more blue-collar, hands-on. They weren't much for theology. They hadn't been to Bible school or anything, which is fine. I don't mean that derogatorily. He was a pilot and a mechanic, and so they went out with Mission Aviation Fellowship, and they said, "We're going to Haiti." We used to get prayer letters from them with no complaint at all, just saying, "Yeah, we ate dinner and then we lay on the floor," because usually right after dinner is when all the bullets are flying. And so we found if we just lay flat on the floor, the bullets, they shoot pretty high, so they just like hit the wall and then we're fine. And after the soldiers leave, then we just get up and have our evening. But Mark and Glee can live with that without having a heart attack. They did for decades. So we sent five of our best. You know, these weren't people where we thought, well, we won't really miss them. So these were all some of the best. They're still dear friends of mine to this day, many of them. And our church said, these are ours, and we're sending our best. And so the church collectively said, we want to be the most generous financial partner any of these couples have. We want to give more of their support than any other church gives. Now, you send five couples in the same year saying, we want to pay more than anybody else will pay to get them there, you're looking at a lot of financial creative challenge. Boy, the excitement in that place was alive. And all five went. One of the ways we raised money for the three couples going to Rio was we figured out how many miles was it from our town to Rio. And then we said to people, we're going to do, you know, you have these bike-a-thons and everybody can pledge so much a mile on your bike. So we said, we're going to bike to Rio and back. The thing is, we're just not leaving. So we said to people, do you go to the gym and ride a stationary bike? Well, you have to clock, I don't know what it was, like 7,000-8,000 miles in the next 8 months. But get all your friends to pledge and tell them you're riding to Rio and back. You're just not going anywhere. We raised a lot of money. We even had T-shirts, ride to Rio. It was great. But we were going, and see, here it is, Acts 13, it's Antioch. So here's the thing that strikes me from this passage. When God's Spirit is working and moving, it doesn't always mean that externally we're relocating. But it does mean movement, and sometimes the movement is internal in our life. We're growing or we're feeling stretched or we're actually realizing a lot of our flaws and weaknesses and it feels really uncomfortable, but there's movement. But it's not just internal movement. God's Spirit creates movement. It's internal movement and it changes how we do, what we do, where we do it. I imagine if you're like the first service when I said the word go and now you had to think and react, and some people said, I have questions. Well, where would I go? Who would I go to? How would I get there? When do I do this? What am I supposed to do when I go? If you look here, you don't really get answers to that. So I think the answer is you kind of don't need to know sometimes. We'll kind of get a part answer as we go along. But the Holy Spirit didn't give them like a complete manual here. End of verse 3, verse 2 and 3, set apart for me Barnabas and Saul for the work to which I've called them. So they fasted, they prayed, they placed hands on them and sent them off. That's it. Well, who are we going to go to? Who are you going to go to? This is where I love the simplicity of it. The two of them, sent on their way by the Holy Spirit, so they're going, went down to Seleucia and sailed from there to Cyprus. Why Cyprus? Because Barnabas is from Cyprus. Because that's where he knows people. Because that's the place he's got relationships. That is where they went. You can read it on your own, Acts 13. So they go to the island of Cyprus. And what are we going to do when we get to Cyprus? Well, we both understand Judaism and Old Testament really well, but we can show how Jesus fulfills Old Testament. So let's start in the synagogue. So that wasn't very hard to figure out. So they do. They get a pretty good response. Then they start going town to town through the whole island of Cyprus. And then as God opens doors and interesting things happen, they end up sharing the gospel with the guy who governs the whole island. They didn't plan it on the front end. They just let God work as they were going. And then they keep going. Verse 14 of chapter 13 says, from Perga they went to Pisidian Antioch. It's a different Antioch. It's up in Asia Minor. And on the Sabbath, well, what are we going to do in Pisidian Antioch? I don't know. We have Jewish background. We understand the Old Testament. We can help people understand Jesus using the Old Testament as a starting point. Let's go to the synagogue. And so they do. And they present Christ to people that they have some common affinity and connection and common ground with. They present the gospel at great length. Look at verse 32. We tell you the good news, what God promised our ancestors, he has fulfilled for us, their children, by raising up Jesus. It's not a complicated message. Jesus died and Jesus is alive, and there's great news in that. Verse 38. Therefore, my friends, I want you to know that through Jesus, the forgiveness of sins is proclaimed to you. Through him, everyone who believes is set free from every sin, a justification you were not able to obtain under the law of Moses. I like how New Living Translation gives it a little more winsomely. We're here to proclaim forgiveness of sins in Jesus and how you can be right with God, something law could never do. That's almost verbatim what I said to Moses at the pool in Uganda 2,000 years after these guys said it. It's not a complicated message. You just got to go and then let God open stuff. Verse 42, as Paul and Barnabas were leaving the synagogue, the people, again, NIV kind of weak on this translation, but I'll shed a little light on it. Paul and Barnabas getting ready to leave the synagogue after sharing the good news of Jesus with the people. And it says, the people invited them to speak further about these things on the next Sabbath. That's actually not what the language says. What it literally is the people were hungry for more and begged them to speak further about this new news. They hit receptive soil. Not everybody, but they sure hit some. So I think Jesus' middle name is either go or give. God so loved the world that he gave his only son. Okay, so let's pause for a moment because you're thinking, this, I can't argue with you. It's in the passage. Sounds good. What's that got to do with me? And I know Paul's about to tell me I have to go somewhere. And the answer is no, I'm not. You're here. You're in L.A. Now, for many of you, you might be thinking, well, yeah, but I'm here because I wanted to take this natural talent I have and see if I can make a career of it or see if I can make it in the industry. And so I didn't come here because God sent me here. I mean, maybe he kind of did, but I came here because I'm pursuing a career or I'm pursuing a dream. Okay, nothing wrong about that. So here's my question, because what I want to do is expand for us our understanding of what go actually means spiritually. I'm back in the Old Testament now, just a story, you don't have to look at it. Remember Joseph and his brothers? And then he ends up in Egypt. At what point did Joseph say, oh, God called me and sent me to Egypt? Remember the story? His brothers, very jealous of him, decide they're going to kill him. And then they decide, why kill him when you can actually make money if you sell him? So your own brothers turn on you and sell you to another country for money. So is it possible that as Joseph, now sold as a slave, and heading to a country that he's never been to and has no desire to go to, as he's rumbling along toward Egypt as a slave, does that mean he was bound? I don't know, probably, but whatever the case. Was it at that point Joseph said, it's okay, because even though my brother sold me as a slave for money because they hate me so much, God's calling me to Egypt. I know he is. I just don't see that. He gets to Egypt. He works as a slave in a fairly well-to-do guy's household, eventually gains the trust of the homeowner, and so he's given more responsibility as a slave in the household, except there's a problem. Remember the story? The guy's wife decides she thinks Joseph is hot stuff, so she makes the moves on Joseph, and Joseph refuses. So then, offended and embarrassed, she accuses him of attempting to rape her. Not true, but the owner of the house believes his wife, and so Joseph, who hasn't done anything wrong, now finds himself in prison in Egypt. So maybe when he was sitting in prison, and I don't think it was lovely setting, he's sitting in prison, falsely accused of something, because his brothers sold him there. Is he sitting in prison saying, it's okay, because God called me to Egypt? I don't think so. But he has a talent for interpreting dreams, and he interprets the dreams of some fellow prisoners, the baker, the candlestick maker, and everybody else that was there. And then he says, don't forget me. You know, if you survive, remember, tell people there's a guy in prison who you know, he's got a talent for interpreting dreams, and they forget him. And at that point, did he say, it's okay, because God called me to Egypt, and I'm forgotten in jail, rotting away, but it's okay? No, I don't think so. And then much time passes, and eventually the ruler of Egypt has these terrible nightmare dreams. Nobody can interpret them, and finally somebody goes, you know, I think there was this guy in the jail. And so now here he is, and he interprets the dream and explains it to the ruler of Egypt, who says, I'm going to make you second in command of all of Egypt, because this is amazing that you can interpret my dream. And he becomes, in our language, the prime minister of Egypt. And then did he say, ah, God sent me to Egypt? I don't know. And then eventually the famine forces all his brothers to have to come begging for food in Egypt. And here they are before him, but they don't even recognize him. And chance for revenge. And instead he says, you meant it for evil, and God meant it for good. So apparently he's starting to, in the rearview mirror, realize, I think God wanted me in Egypt. He never totally loved Egypt. As he got older, he tells his descendants, when I die, do not bury me here. Put my bones in a box and take them with you, and when you get back to native Israeli soil, bury me there. This is not home. He spent the rest of his life living somewhere that he always felt like he was a foreigner. Had a homesick longing, so much so that he said, bury me there. So I'm a native Southern Californian who's lived for 27 years as a very well-treated house guest in Minneapolis. This is home, and I don't get to be home. I get to come visit home every month, thank you, Ecclesia, but I don't get to live home. And part of the things I think about is, am I going to die in Minneapolis someday? And I told my wife, don't bury me here. It's not home. I got nothing to say bad about Minneapolis except the weather, which is horrific. But it's not home. But it's where God sent me. He and I still have to talk about that. I think he might be a little geography challenged. But anyway, so the church I'm having the three great years in, right, with the five couples, our best going out. And those three great years were followed by three withering, exhausting, awful, trying years. Maybe it's because our five best couples left and it changed the environment. I don't know. But by the end of those second three awful years, I was burned out, shot, depressed, and didn't have the energy to pastor. I wanted to. I was out of gas, literally. And so I find myself sitting in an interview with a guy who had founded a nonprofit that worked with at-risk teenagers, and they want to hire a guy to raise funds, and they're talking to me. And they have this extensive interview process, and at the end of it, Fred looks me in the eye and he says, it's very important whoever takes this job feels called here. Do you feel called? And I remember thinking, I'm not going to lie, and I need this job. So what's the answer? So I said to him, well, when you say feel called, you got to remember, I come out of a pastoral background. That's a huge word to me. And call is overt for me. And now you're asking me, do I feel called to this? And so I looked at him and I said, when did Joseph feel called to Egypt? It was true. And I also thought it was foggy enough that he would just go, oh. And he didn't. So I said, when did Joseph feel called to Egypt? And Fred looked at me and he said, you're hired. And I smiled inside and I thought, he just doesn't know what I'm talking about. And over the coming months and years, Fred became and remains a wonderful friend and mentor to me. And I came to know his story, and he knew exactly what I was talking about. Because he'd been Joseph in Egypt. And when I said it, he knew. God put me somewhere where someone knew exactly what I was going through. I learned so much from there. I thought I'd be there a year. I didn't even unpack my pastoral books. I left them in a box, put them under my desk, and I thought, as soon as the church calls, I'm out of here. I didn't tell Fred that at the time. I was affiliated with that ministry 15 years. I was in Egypt a long time, and it was good. But I didn't want to stay there. But at what point did I realize God actually sent me to that ministry? I don't know. I couldn't really tell you. But that's where I found myself. And God used me, and God was growing me and doing stuff in me that I had to grow up at. So I think sometimes our sense of sent or going, it's like we always have to, we have to have the awareness and cooperate with it. And what I would say is it's placement. You're here. Regardless of why, you're in L.A. I came to chase my career. I came because my relatives live here. I came because my spouse or the person I'm dating is here. Or it doesn't, in a sense, it doesn't matter. Lots of reasons. But if you're here and you know the Lord, you're here. And you're here for a reason. And the reason is to be a presence. Not to come to a building that has more and more people crowding into it. I would love, if we could somehow figure out how to do it, to project up on our screens a map of LA. And then have every Ecclesian where you live and work. So I'm making this up now. Where you live is a blue light and where you work is a green light. And just have the whole map light up. And I think what we'd see is, oh my, God knows what he's doing. Look, he's placed some of his people here, and some live there, and some work here, even if they don't want to work there right now, but they're there now. And that's just Ecclesia. What if we plug in other churches? God knows what he's doing. But God's heart is go. And in some ways, you guys, we don't even have to figure out where I need to go. We just need to look and go, I guess I'm there. I guess I'm in Egypt, if it's Egypt for you, or whatever you want to call it. But what if we suddenly saw where we are as divinely orchestrated, whether it felt like it or not? You're placed because you belong to him. And the very nature of God is to go and to give, not to hoard. Oh, it's my day. I'm not sharing it with somebody. No, it's the opposite of that. Give it away. And he's got us spread all over LA, and he's got you living next to the people you live next door to, and he's got you working with the people you work with, and it may not be the job you want, but maybe those people need Jesus. So I'm coming out on the plane here last night, late flight, and lucky me, I get upgraded for free by Delta, because if you fly to Africa enough, I guess then they treat you nicer. So I'm in first class coming out here. How nice is that? And I'm sitting in this big, nice, cushy chair instead of the little squished thing for me. And it was really nice, so I appreciate that. Except the guy right in front of me is part of a group of four guys who are drinking the whole time. And he's getting loud and obnoxious and close to offensive, and he's starting to flirt with a flight attendant. And I'm just thinking, aww. And the first word that came to my mind was jerk. So I was sitting there thinking, what a jerk. And then, maybe it's because I was thinking about the sermon today, who knows, but the Lord said, well, Paul, do you think it's an accident you're sitting one row behind a jerk? And I found myself changing my whole outlook and starting to pray for this guy. Lord, I don't know who this guy is. I don't know why he drinks so much. I know he needs you. I can tell by his language he doesn't know you. Instead of judging him or hating him, I thought, I'm placed there for a reason. So close your eyes and imagine, and then we're going to head to communion. And dismiss that this might be a bit cheesy, because I think it's helpful. A tandem ride with God. Are you picturing it in your head? I used to think of God as my observer, my judge, keeping track of the things I did wrong so that I would know whether I had earned heaven or hell when I die. He was out there like a president, sort of distant. I recognized his picture when I saw it, but I didn't really know him. And then later, when I met Jesus, it seemed as though life was rather like a bike, like a tandem bike. I noticed Jesus was in the back helping me pedal. I didn't know just when it was. He suggested we change, but life has not been the same since I took the back seat to Jesus, my Lord. He makes life exciting. When I had control, I thought I knew the way. It was rather boring, but predictable. It was the shortest distance between two points. And then when he took the lead, he knew delightful long cuts up mountains and through rocky places at breakthrough speeds. It was all I could do to hang on, even though it often looked like madness. And he would just say, "Pedal." I was worried and anxious. I would ask, "Where are you taking me?" And he would laugh, often wouldn't answer at all. I started to learn trust. I began to forget my boring life and started to enter into this adventure. And when I would say I'm scared, he would lean back, grip my hand. He took me to people with gifts that I needed, gifts of healing, acceptance, joy. They gave me their gifts to take on my journey. And then we were off again, and he would say to me, "Give the gifts away. Let them benefit someone else." And so I did, giving them to people we met, and I found that in giving I received, and our burden was light. I didn't trust him at first, controlling my life. I worried he might wreck it. It turns out, though, he knows bike secrets. He knows how to make it bend to take sharp corners, jump to clear high rocks, fly to short and scary passages. And me, I'm learning to shut up and pedal. In the strangest places, I'm beginning to enjoy the view, the cool breeze on my face, mostly the delight of my constant companion, Jesus. And when I'm sure I just can't do any more, he smiles and says to me, "Pedal." Would you pray with me? As we come to communion in a moment, as we often do, we ask that you get up and come. What are you saying with your feet? What are you saying as you move to the God whose middle name is Go and Give? And maybe it means you see where you live, where you work, where you play through a new light. Maybe you see that you're a sent one. Maybe you have a different attitude toward people that you've said, "I don't like them. I don't want to be around them." Maybe your dream isn't happening, but is God's dream that you're part of. And so, Lord, we remember your body broken, your blood shed, that you came, you gave. It's changed the trajectories of our lives. And now you place us, and you know what you're doing, that others might also see and hear and know. And so those who are going to serve us will come forward, and when you feel ready, come, make a statement with your feet. There's gluten-free in the bowl as well. Thank you, Lord, for your great love. Amen.
Thanks for listening. To find out more, please visit churchinhollywood.com.